The Senate will please come back to order. Messages from the House.
February the 10th, 2011, from the House of the Representatives, message concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 15, Court Jurisdiction. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 39, noes 20, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. February the 10th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 17, Probation and Parole Amendments. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. February the 10th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 23, Mail Ballot Elections. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, noes 1, excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. February the 10th, 2011, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 2, State Treasurer's Reports. Ayes 59, excused 1. Senate File 11, CHINS, Administrative Change of Placement. Ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. Senate File 22, Wind Energy Property Rights. Ayes 59, excused 1. Senate File 28, State Parks Volunteers. Ayes 59, excused 1. Senate File 31, Off-Road Vehicle Definition. Ayes 59, excused 1. Senate File 32, State Parks Trails. Ayes 59, excused 1. And Senate File 110, School Facilities Commission Reorganization. Ayes 59, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 10th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 41, Film Industry Financial Incentives Program. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 45, noes 12, excused 3. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 136, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 63, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Scott? Do pass amended. Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 88, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 9th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 50, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 9th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 49, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 69, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 160, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Vice President, House Bill 49, Primary Care Support Program, and House Bill 50, Health Insurance Exchanges, both joint interim bills, which were just read in, both carry appropriations, and I ask they both be re-referred to committee number 2.
Without objection, House Bill 49 and 50 are re-referred to House or Senate committee number 2, appropriations. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business, consideration of files on general file, bills on general file.
Mr. Vice President, I move the Verizon report.
Everybody go home.
Vice President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senator Cooper.
Committee of the Whole, please come back to order. First bill for our consideration this afternoon is House Bill 105. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 105, Temporary Military Duty, Child Custody and Visitation, and Act Relating to Child Custody and Visitation, sponsored by Representative Throne. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins, Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Burns.
I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 105. There are no standing committee amendments. And for further discussion of the bill, I ask that you call on the good senator from Sweetwater County.
Senator Hastert, let's see, get you over here.
Chairman, I bring House Bill 105 and ask for your favorable consideration. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 105 deals with putting a new section in which protects the child custody rights of deployed parents. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, during the current war on terror, the military has seen a rise in mobilization and deployments, which have led to more divorces. Now, more than ever, service personnel are faced with child custody matters before, during, and after their mobilization, which has led to an increase in distractions that interfere with the military mission and which result in an adverse impact on the unit and individual readiness, safety, and morale. A typical situation, Mr. Chairman, involves a divorced service member with legal joint custody of his or her children, with primary physical custody with the service member. The service member is then deployed, forcing the service member to arrange for child care during deployment. Either before and frequently during the deployment, the non-custodial parent files an action to permanently modify the existing child custody order, seeking physical custody of the child or children based in large part on the custodial parent's absence due to the deployment. The Service Members Civil Relief Act may not fully protect the service member faced with the child custody actions because the courts are not required to grant a stay of the action. If the modification is granted, the service member faces an uphill battle to regain custody because the status quo and having to demonstrate a material change in circumstances warranting further modification. So it's become quite an issue when parents are deployed. And, Mr. Chairman, I have a personal note on this where an individual that I'm aware of lost custody of a child that he was married, and the child was from his previous wife that had deceased. And while he was deployed, she was able to use his power of attorney and get custody of this child, or adopt basically this child, and now they're getting divorced and she's seeking custody because of this. All this happened while he was deployed. So, Mr. Chairman, as I had stated earlier, the bill creates a new section in Title 20 which protects the child custody rights of deployed parents by requiring that modification orders be temporary, and then for automatic termination of temporary orders and reinstatement of the prior pre-deployment custody orders upon return of the deployed parent without court action, making clear that military service is a neutral factor in determining material change in circumstances, and further that military service alone does not constitute a material change in circumstances warranting modification to existing custody orders. It provides for delegation of visitation rights of service personnel to family members with close relationships to the children, and providing for expedited hearings and electronic communications in custody proceedings. And, Mr. Chairman, as you will see in the bill, that it's just also still keeping the consideration, the needs, and best interests of the child at heart. Now, walking through the bill, Mr. Chairman, on House Bill 105, at the bottom of page 1, we start with the creation of Section 22205. And on the page 2, in that first section, it speaks to when a deployed service member who has custody gets deployment or mobilization orders and needs to be a substantial distance from the service member's residence. Section 1 adds that any orders establishing the terms of custody can only be temporarily modified when someone is on temporary duty, deployment, or mobilization. And Section 2, that any order shall specify that the service member's military service is the basis for the order, and that the courts solely has as a temporary order. So it's orders that is due to the deployment is only temporary. Mr. Chairman, on page 3, that any temporary custody or visitation orders due to, as a result of temporary duty, shall automatically terminate after 20 days after the service member returns. And, Mr. Chairman, we heard in committee there was a question about the 20 days, and it was discussed that you know, usually when a service member returns, that there is some type of a need for, you know, that it takes a little while to kind of get back to, sometimes back to the residence. It could take a week, up to 10 days maybe. And this just gives a time for the service member to get back to the area where they were deployed from, or back to their home area, and get reacclimated to their residence. Mr. Chairman, then this same paragraph goes on to continue that nothing in this section shall impair the power and discretion of the court for to have a hearing for emergency custody upon return of the service member, and then a hearing will be held within 10 days if needed, and if a motion alleging an immediate danger or irreparable harm to the child. So here in this section, it again takes into consideration issues if they're of the child if needed. Next paragraph 4 on the bottom of the page, 15 through 23, again speaks that the temporary duty mobilization or deployment of the service member and resulting temporary disruption to the child's schedule shall be a neutral factor in determining changes to the or modifications to custody. Mr. Chairman, on page 4, at the top of the page, it talks of a service member with visitation, that the court may delegate the visitation rights to a family member, and it says there that has to have a close or substantial relationships to the minor child, and that if delegated visitation rights is in the child's best interest. So here again, taking into consideration the needs of the child. Upon motion of a service member in Section C, members of the Senate, is that the temporary duty deployment, if there is a pending court case for divorce, that it can be expedited to be handled before a deployment is happening. And then in Section D, allows electronic testimony so that if someone is deployed, that there would can be that the court may allow for electronic means of the parent to testify in the court proceedings. And then in Section E on page 5, again, it says nothing in this section shall alter the duty of the court to consider the best interest of the child. Section F, we get into the definitions of deployment. On page 6, Section 2 is mobilization, what return, the service member, and temporary duties mean. And that then on the bottom of page 7, that anytime the court considers custody or visitation rights of a service member, they will take into consideration the new section there in 22205. Then on page 8, it talks about the jurisdiction of the courts, and that the new section in this is that a service member's temporary duty, deployment, or mobilization as defined in 22205 shall not alter any court's continuing jurisdiction under this section. And then on 22204, enforcements and modification, this section is amended to say that any modification under this subsection shall be subject to the limitations and requirements in 22205. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill, and what it's trying to do is allow for service members to be deployed, and then if there is marital issues, that they don't have to worry that there are any permanent modifications can be made to their custody rights or have them rescinded, and that the fact that they're in the military and deployed has no bearing with the court on whether they're a fit parent or have any issues with that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill, and I'll stand for questions.
Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Ross. As I find you again. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think members of the Senate, this is getting up talking on this bill is like talking against God and country, but there are some major issues that we need to discuss here. And you all know, and this probably isn't going to be a fair debate, because the sponsor of this bill is not an attorney. But I will tell you that this is an area in which I almost exclusively practice anymore in domestic relations. And, of course, we have an Air Force base here. We have the National Guard here. And we are faced with these issues all the time in court. And quite frankly, I haven't had a real problem, particularly with this court here in Laramie County that has to deal with these issues concerning our military folks. I will tell you that I cannot think of at a time where I have not been able to stay an action that is pending when a deployment occurs under what used to be called the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act, which provides that you can't have a case while they're out and being deployed. But there are serious issues here, folks, in terms of what we're doing, particularly and I'm going to go through some of the issues I have here. And it's not, while I sympathize with the intent of the bill, I'm not sure that the language really works very well. If you go to page 3 and you look at the Romanet 3, and it says that if there's this temporary order where, let's say, couple's divorced, dad is deployed to Iraq, so mom's going to have the child. Mom's got the child, there's temporary order for her to have the child. The child is in school. And then he returns from his deployment in the middle of the school year. This says that 20 days after service, after the service member returns, the order is automatically reinstated. Now, it does provide that there could be a hearing within 10 days, but the grounds for that are immediate danger or irreparable harm. I'm not sure what that is. But I can tell you this, it's probably not in the best interest of the child to uproot the child in the middle of the school semester. And generally the court's going to say, you know, that's probably not a good idea. We should let that child finish that school semester and we'll go back to where we were. But under this, it automatically terminates unless you're going to do this 10 days hearing. And then I'm not sure that situation fits within immediate danger or irreparable harm. Then we go on in paragraph 4 to say that the temporary disruption for the child shall be neutral factors. Well, they're not neutral. What we've done in the situation with divorces is you're taking a stabilized situation and then automatically destabilizing it. And the primary goal of the court is to create some stability. And to create that stability certainly doesn't happen when all of a sudden you can just uproot the child from the school and move that child back to wherever the father's now at. That's just one example that comes to the top of my mind. Then if you go over to paragraph B on page 4, we are creating, it seems to me, a visitation right that we have never granted before. We do provide for grandparents' visitation rights, and we do provide for custodial carekeeper visitation rights and provide a separate cause of action. But paragraph B on page 4 says that the court may delegate the service member's visitation rights to somebody with a close and substantial relationship. What does delegate mean? Does that mean that there's a hearing? I don't know. Does it mean that the court can do it sua sponte on its own? I don't know. But these are issues that when you start getting into that, the court generally is pretty good about protecting the child's best interests. And I'm really fearful when you start doing some of this stuff that you're taking away some of the discretion of the court to handle the factual situation as it's presented in court. Because that's really what ultimately dictates how these matters are resolved. And every case's facts is different. You may have children in two different states. You may have them in two different counties. Or you may have them in the same locale. But in the end, you have to seriously consider what's going on here. And does this really accomplish the goals that you'd like to do? Which is to apparently maintain status quo while the serviceman is deployed. I'm cool with that. I can be okay with that to a certain degree. But I think that this thing is more fraught with unintended consequences than we really think. And then, when you go in on page, the last page, I believe it is 2-2-201. 2-201 is disposition and maintenance of children in a decree. And while most of the statute is not in this bill, it adds a new paragraph. Paragraph A sets forth a whole litany of from Romanet 1 down to Romanet 10 as to the factors the court should consider in custody cases, whether it be new custody cases, initial custody cases, modification custody, enforcement cases. Those are the criteria. And then you say in paragraph G, any time the court is considering custody of a service member, court shall comply with this. What if the guy isn't necessarily deployed? Is this have we raised that to a higher status? I don't know. But I'm just telling you, it's not that simple. And we ought to take a serious, serious look at what this bill is doing.
Further discussion on the bill. Senator Hastert.
While the good majority leader is right in the fact that the one here presenting the bill is not an attorney, I think the main sponsor is, and this was done in concert with JAGS, the military. But just to try and get into a couple of these things, and he raises some concerns, and as with anything, you know, we have a legislation that is, remember, designed, it was for deployed parents. We have moms as well as dads deployed, but a lot of times, and we had one of the moms come into the committee meeting to talk about this. Now, the questions on in Section 4, the purpose determining custody and visitation after the return, you know, and we define a lot of these things. It's pretty narrowly defined that, it has to be deployed or temporarily deployed. Not necessarily is it going to be to a foreign country. It could be, but most of the time our deployments, what we're seeing in the Guard, and especially are either, to a couple of different places, but they're usually somewhere across the country. And it's a temporary duty mobilization or deployment of the service member. Just saying in Section 4, it just is a neutral factor. If someone is deployed and a member of the military, should they be penalized in a custody case just because that they're deployed? They're in service to the country, and there's a lot of things, and I'm not trying to make this emotional or anything else, but the facts are the facts that someone that is deployed chooses to join the military service and is deployed, it's just simply saying that it's a neutral factor. Someone can't say that being deployed is a detriment to the custody. So that's what that section just talks about. It's just saying a neutral factor. It's neither a good thing or a bad thing. Just as it's a neutral factor in that. Page 4, we talk about the visitation rights of a family member. And the intent here is If someone is deployed, if a mom or a dad is deployed, a lot of times they're deployed for over a year. And if you have a situation where it's, you know, not a very civil type of divorce settlement, and a lot of times you see where a custodial parent or someone has temporary custody might be being vindictive. So you have a service member that's gone for the entire year, and that grandma and grandpa, and it specifies that a close and substantial. Close and substantial is written in there, and that the courts determine that the visitation rights is in the best interest of the child. So someone would have to go, if they're not already granted it, if it's someone being vindictive and doesn't allow grandma or grandpa or uncle or whoever to see a child while someone is deployed, they have to go and make a case before the judge, and the judge would have to determine, okay, yeah, you can see the child, and someone from that family can say, hey, mom misses you, or dad misses you, you've been gone for a year, and make sure that there is still those kind of family ties with this. And, you know, the gist of it, and certainly there may be some, some different language issues, I'm not sure, on a couple of things that can be answered, but, you know, this is, and I didn't pass this map out, but if you can see this map in the green areas of the states that have passed this legislation, and the red areas are either not favorable or considering, you know, you can see that this is 90% of the United States have passed laws that help protect a service member. And I'm certainly, willing to look at some of the language issues, if there is any. But, I think it's pretty well written in there. As far as finding unknowns with any of our bills or finding, vagueness in some areas, I can't defend every piece of vague portion that someone might find. But it's written in here clearly in several places that the best interest of the child is to be considered, and that allowing for a substantial parent, or excuse me, a family member with close and substantial relationships. It's in there, and then it also has, like I said, I'll say it again, that the premise is what's in the best interest of the child, and not allowing for the deployment to be either considered favorably or detracting from this.
Senator Ross.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to go back to page 4 and paragraph B at the top there, because there was some talk, the sponsor of the bill was just talking about that with regards to family members. Folks, let's remember how does this occur? When we instituted the grandparents' visitation rights statutes, we gave them a direct cause of action to file. And when you go into the grandparents' visitation rights statute, you will see that there are some conditions in there that it can't impair the custodial rights of the parents. We don't have that in this bill. What we have here is the court apparently being able to delegate that. I'm still not clear what that is. But we haven't given an uncle, a brother, or whomever else a direct cause of action to be able to come in. How do they even get into the court? Unless this court can just simply do that sua sponte, on its own accord. And then I would say, if that's the case, then you got problems with the custodial parent or the parent that is going to have the child during temporary deployment. Do we give this brother, sister, whomever it might be, other relative with a close relationship, do we give them just some rights? What if they're in a different state? And it affects the amount of time or the cost to the custodial parent at the time that perhaps wasn't the original custodian, but clearly when he's deployed or she's deployed somewhere, they're not going to be able to have the child with them as a general rule. And so it's going to go to the other parent. All things being equal, that parent is fit. But there's just a number of issues here that I have a hard time figuring out. How are you going to do this? Have we created a new right? Well, then maybe we should create a new visitation right for these individuals and give them that direct ability to petition the court for those visitation rights. But right now, you certainly don't have it, and this bill doesn't do it.
Further discussion, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is, I think, a bill that's trying to reach out to circumstances that are extraordinary. And I think that we can look at some language changes that the good senator from Laramie County brought up. I think we can go over on page 3, line 13, and add in it's not in the best interest of the child and bring that bar down to there. We can look at areas rather than delegate. We can say that the court shall determine, and we can add some petitioners in there as far as visitation rights. And again, keep that same standard, not in the best interest of the child's best interest. You know, war doesn't happen every day, but when it does, I think we have to do something for our servicemen to keep their families together the best they can. And I think that although this bill isn't perfect, I think people with perfect knowledge of it and the willingness to work at it could probably make this a satisfactory piece of legislation.
Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, if there are a call for the question, all those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 105, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Okay. House Bill 105 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 133. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 133, Special Limited Fishing Permits, an act relating to game and fish, sponsored by Representative Childers. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 133, Special Limited Fishing Permits. There are no standing committee amendments, and for further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on the good senator from Cody, whose name rhymes with Co.
Senator names with Co.
Well, Mr. Chairman, before lunch we had quite a discussion about dogs biting game wardens, and this is about game wardens biting kids. If you'll notice the handout I have here, there's a youth group up in my community that has done some effective lobbying down here over the years, and this is their latest push. What House Bill 133 does, it allows any student enrolled in an accredited school in Wyoming to participate in school fishing trips without purchasing a license, as long as they are in a curriculum-based program and under the direct supervision of the teacher. So they can only use this license with the school curriculum. It's a relatively simple bill. If you look on page 2, you'll see in paragraph 5, that's exactly what it does. Try to answer any questions on the bill.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none. Oops, Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, I'm simply curious about how this would be handled for homeschool situations, things like that, where they're a little less formal. I don't know if any thought's been given to that. Clearly, this is for the children, Mr. Chairman. So good little bill.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take that one on. This little handout you got, it said the law would allow any student enrolled in an accredited school in Wyoming to participate in school fishing trips without purchasing a license as long as they are in a curriculum-based program and under the direct supervision of their teacher in that accredited school. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that means the homeschoolers have to buy a license.
Is there any further discussion on this bill? All right. Seeing none, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 133, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Okay. House Bill 133 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 156. May the reading clerk read the bill.
House Bill 156, Grand Teton.
Hey, guys, you want to hold it down a little bit here, Senators. We're getting a lot of flack up here. Go ahead.
House Bill 156, Grand Teton National Park, transfer of state land and act relating to state lands, sponsored by Representative Petroff. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Geis, and there is a standing committee amendment.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rises and report, I move House Bill 156 do pass, and I'd also move the standing committee amendments and have it read in.
House Bill 156, standing committee amendment number 1, page 3, line 1.
Did you make a motion on that, Senator Geis?
I did.
Oh, on the
standing committee amendment?
Standing committee.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Proceed.
I'll yield the floor to Senator Christensen, and he'll handle the bill, and he can also handle a standing committee amendment if he likes.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, today we have in front of us House Bill 156. I'll just share a little bit of history with you, if I can. In the packets that have gone around, there's quite a bit of information. I'll just touch briefly on some of those points, but if we could refer to some of them, it might help. And then you can do the additional reading if you'd like at another time. But the sheet that talks about House Bill 156, Teton Park was created in 1929. In 1950, the park boundaries were expanded to include four school trust parcels that amounted to 1,366 surface acres and 39.59 acres of mineral rights. The State Lands and Investment Board have worked for over 30 years to try to get the federal government to trade these lands, to trade lands for these parcels or to purchase the parcels. The department has not been motivated to do so because they've had free use of the land up until today. Over the years, there's been a frustration by the lack of cooperation and lack of reasonable trade offers or purchase offers. Our late Senator Craig Thomas took this on and was instrumental in getting the conversation going, but they stalled out on his passing. In 2010, you may have been aware, we certainly were back in the home community, when Governor Friedenthal announced that without some cooperation and some working together, he would be putting the land up or moving the land forward for public auction. As a result, it did generate some conversation, and it took a while, but in December, there was an announcement that an agreement had been arrived at, and a contract, in fact, the agreement was consolidated right down to a contract, and it was put forward, and the terms of the agreement were signed. We'll talk about that in a little bit. In the committee testimony, I'd just like to share with you a little bit other history, and that is when our Secretary of State, Joe Meyer, gave the personal view of it, and how he had worked on this for years in trying to come up with some way to get value out of that land that could benefit the schools and benefit the children, their education. And he spoke of trade opportunities. He spoke about purchase prices. He talked about the difficulties of trying to come up with good land to trade, whether it was with mineral properties or just raw land, and that what they ran into was quite often it turned into a three-way trade and trying to make the BLM whole, respecting the park and respecting the state. It just wasn't working out. We'd also heard in those meetings about offers to just do straight trades, but at times the lands that were offered actually, it was suggested, would have cost more to manage them than they were worth. So in the outcome of that agreement last fall in December is the Department of Interior agreed to acquire those 1,366 acres of state school section lands for a full appraised value of $107 million. And this is, just for your information, this was the first favorable assessment that we've had. And like I said, there were other substandard offers, but this is the first time that we really got in there and were able to assess that land. And we were fortunate at the time when they came up with the values is there had been another park land purchase. And so there was a equivalent out there to really come up with the value, and it wasn't just purely speculative. This exchange will allow the taxpayers and the school interest to be fairly compensated while protecting the integrity of the parks and its ability to maintain a positive economic impact to our state. If I could draw your attention to the bill itself, House Bill 56, the transfer of state lands, an act relating to or directing the interest of certain state lands to be transferred to the United States Department of Interior, providing terms for the transfer, and providing an effective date. And then on page 1, down at paragraph A, line 10, it goes on to say the Board of Land Commissioners is authorized to convey all its rights, title, and interest in the following parcels. Before we go on to page 2 particularly, if you could find the map in there, we'll refer to the map a little bit. Just so everybody knows where we're talking about. I think it's in your packet, colored map. Don't be confused with all the red spots. This is the park's map, and so they highlighted the private in holdings within their park. It's the yellow parcels we're talking about that are crosshatched. It says state land down in the corner. There are four parcels, and let's just start up at the top, and you can see the small yellow square, 08-167. That's known as the Jackson Lake parcel. And that particular parcel is mineral rights. Okay, that's the one we're talking about that's mineral rights. Moving on down, the Snake River parcel, if you just go on to the lower left-hand side of the map, there's a little yellow piece down there that's in the river, along the edge of the river, and that's 02-118. And that's in and on the edge of the river. And then over at parcel number 3, up right in the center of your map, is the Antelope Flats parcel. Now that one, the Snake River parcel is 86 acres. The Antelope Flats parcel is 640 acres. And if you've been through Teton Park lately, if you'll visualize the big flats just out north of town a ways, north of the airport, and that's where that is. It's just setting off on the east side of the highway. And then the last parcel is called the Kelly parcel, another 640. Now, The first three parcels, if you look at them closely, there isn't really good access. The one on the Snake River, the public could access by coming down the river. You could float to it. But other than that, they're all in the middle of park land. Now, the Kelly parcel, the Grovant Road that heads up the Grovant Canyon, does go along the southern edge of that piece. And if you've traveled up there, that it's kind of in those rolling foothills. Continuing on with the bill, the down at the page 2, if we'll look down at line 22, the conveyances authorized by this subsection of this section shall be by sale at not less than the appraised value, with the terms of the sale to be determined by the Board of Land Commissioners. And that's that contract we're referring to that was put together back in December. The proceeds of the sale, over onto page 3, line 3, proceeds of the sale shall be deposited for the common school account within the permanent land fund. And then in section 2, this act is effective immediately upon completion of all acts necessary for a bill to become law. The amendment, if we could maybe address the amendment right now, and then I'll continue on. But the amendment that you have in front of us applies to page 3, line 1, and it's just a clarification on the title up there, deleting the Board of Land Commissioners and inserting the Board of Land Commissioners, but it changes it from a title to more of the sentence. And then on down on page 3, line 5, brings in insert. The Board of Land Commissioners shall execute and deliver to the Department of Interior in a form reasonably acceptable to the Department a document or form of deed conveying title to the parcels described in subsection A of this section only upon payment of the agreed amount for each parcel. Now, that amendment, that is some good language. I'll share with you that language is generally in the contract. But it doesn't hurt to have this language right in the bill to help keep it clear. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, if we could recommend approval of the amendment.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Would you like to call for the question, Senator Christensen? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment, number 1, to House Bill 156, please say aye. Opposed, say no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 156 has passed. We're now back on the bill. Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on the bill? We're back on the bill. Senator Christensen. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue on.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in the packet that was given to you, there is the agreement of conveyance for the land of lands and between the State of Wyoming Board of Land Commissioners and the United States of America. And if I could draw your attention to that document, there's just, we won't read the whole thing, but there's a couple of important parts in this that would, it's worthy of your attention, I think. I think the whole document is, but we'll just touch on a little bit of it. And on page 2 of that document, the first whereas, it says the Wyoming Constitution directs the board to generate a reasonable income from these trust lands to support Wyoming public schools. And whereas the state school trust beneficiaries are not able to fully realize the relative economic value of these lands because they are within Grand Teton National Park. I think what they're referring to there is, as the land stands today and the way it's been used, it's been leased out. Our most current lease rate on that has been $1,600 a year. Not much of a return on this. And while we still own the land, that's pretty cheap rent. Some of the land is compromised by its location and people can't get to it. And so I think that all plays into it, but not much of a return. And then if I could ask you to go down to the fifth whereas on page 2, it says public law authorizes federal acquisition of state lands by donation, purchase, or exchange of certain federal lands, and whereas public law directs the secretary to identify additional federal lands or interests therein that could potentially be used in an exchange, and to provide that information in a report to Congress. What that refers to is what I mentioned earlier when we were looking at examining opportunities for trade and the obstacles that had been run up against. Over on page 4 of the agreement, over on page 4, if we can go down to the third paragraph, it says, as long as the department, well, up at the top of it, phased acquisition. This is important to know because part of the, I think, the great idea of this agreement, when it was arrived at, you can see there's an order of sale, and it lists the appraised price and the deadline with which to complete that sale, parcel one being that Jackson Lake piece. A little bit, when it says Jackson Lake, how many of us would like 40 acres on Jackson Lake for $2,000? But it's not on Jackson Lake. It's actually off the west side of the highway. I think it's over in the trees and the potholes, and some have described it as being underwater. And again, it's just the mineral rights. Our best mineral that we've used in that country has been gravel coming off that Snake River area. So, and then number two, and you can see that deadline is January 5th of 2012, just a year from now. The second package to be purchased and completed is a Snake River parcel on down the Snake River for $16 million, January 5th, 2013. The third parcel, Antelope Flats, again, that one's 640 acres for $45 million, January 5th, 2014. And then the last piece is the Kelly parcel on the Grovant Road, $46 million. In 2015. Why this is important to know is in that third paragraph, it says, as long as the department acquires the parcels by the respective deadline set forth, the department will hold a binding option to purchase the remainder of the parcels. If the department fails to acquire each parcel by its specified deadline, the board may terminate this agreement as to any remaining parcels. Each parcel must be acquired in total by the department before the department can acquire the next parcel. The that idea of selling off the little ones that are maybe the price is lower, but also that the park would like, but it holds that last piece, that Kelly parcel, as the last one, and I think that's really to the benefit of the state. It offers some protection. That's the piece of ground that is probably most easily used. It's bordering up to the forest, borders the parks, it's in the rolling lands. It's quite a beautiful piece of land. And so the order of this, I thought, was really in the best interest of the state. And whoever came up with this, it was a great plan. This document, we'll stop on this document, but it has been signed. And but that signature then is pending approval by the legislature, or the document is pending approval. Okay. There's some concerns and conversation, ladies and gentlemen, about the legality of this and some constitutional questions you may hear raised. And we heard it in committee. We visited about it. And when you look at the plain language of the Constitution, it does imply, or it does talk directly about auction. However, I'll share with you that In both committees that I attended when the reports were given, and the one just two nights ago, the Senate committee, the legal foundation for this, when the question about constitutionality was really laid out in a solid way. And if I can just touch on some of it, the Wyoming legislature has the power and has used it to direct the transfer or sale of these lands exactly as this bill proposes. In 2003, the Supreme Court ruled that state trust lands, like the sections of land to be sold here, are not subject to constitutional trust, but were instead subject to statutory trust. And that's where we come in. That's where we come in and are able to approve or have a say at this. And the example that was used was Mirbanko, and it was the director of the Office of State Lands and Investments versus Mirbanko, which was a school section up in Teton County out by Teton Village. And in that one, the Supreme Court again said that not subject to constitutional trust, but instead statutory trust. The legislature has the power to direct the transfer of state school lands, and that is pursuant to the Wyoming Supreme Court's interpretation of Article 18, Section 1 and Section 3 of the Wyoming Constitution. Since at least 2003, the law has been that the legislature can direct the transfer of specific school trust lands as long as the state receives fair market value in exchange for the lands. And our state has acted with this authority on several occasions. The legislature has transferred school trust lands to other state entities without the requirement of a public auction. Some of those, transfer of school trust lands to Guernsey in 2001, transfer of school trust lands to Newcastle in 2007, transfer of school trust lands to Uinta County in 2007. Now, there is one more that becomes very, I think, is really important. When we talk about that option of public auction, it was a few years ago up in Teton County when there was an appeal made to access some school land, and it was known as Boyle's Hill, just straight west of Jackson, of the town of Jackson. And 649 acres went up for public auction. And it didn't really make much news until after the sale. And when it went to public auction, 649 acres, which has since been turned into one of the most exclusive and beautiful subdivisions on that Boyle's Hill and those springs and that area just west of Jackson, sold for $5.51 million. Now, prices have changed a little bit. But even then, when the deal was done, people looked around and said, "What just happened?" And it was that idea of going to public auction for these big dollar amounts. Only $5 million for 600 acres. And that was all usable and has been very well developed. Ladies and gentlemen, in your packet, you also will have opinion from the Attorney General's office. Now, it's not just this opinion. Please take a look at that at your leisure. It refers to the process and going through that and examining and basically verifying these past cases and supporting them, making sure this applies. But our past attorney general has looked at it. We've had two different administrations look at it. And I'd suggest that with the work that's been done and the keen legal minds that have really looked into this for the good of Wyoming and the good of the children in the school, there's been quite a review. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's stay with this Attorney General's opinion. And you go in there and you see all of the what fors and how dos and everything, and then he goes back and says that he uses, for instance, the Lassen versus Arizona Highway Department case that went to Supreme Court. And what this is they had some trust land, wanted to build an interstate through it, and they ended up in Supreme Court, which shows you if you're going to go to court with the guys that want your land, you don't have much of a chance of doing it. So that right there of this Arizona deal is the basis of what our Attorney General used. Now, Mr. Chairman, go read your Constitution. Now, you can have a bunch of fancy lawyers and judges and all this kind of stuff go out there and change the name of your land from trust land to statutory land so they can sell it. But when you read the Constitution, it says such lands shall be disposed of only at public auction to the highest responsible bidder after having been duly appraised by the land commissioners and on and on. Now, this is land that we accepted from the federal government, and these were the conditions that we accepted it. So if we're going to, and this is for the schools. But it wasn't just once in our Constitution they mentioned it. You go in Article 18 down to the Board of Land Commissioners, and it describes them, the governor, the secretary of state, the state treasurer, state auditor, and superintendent of public instruction shall constitute a board of land commissioners, which under the direction of the legislature, as limited by this constitution. It describes the lands. It calls them trust lands. It says you can have to have a public auction. Then it gives us the authority to dispose of this land as long as we obey the Constitution. And it goes on to say that leasing, disposal of land of the state or which may be hereafter granted for the assistance and benefit of the schools subject to the further limitation of the sale shall be at public auction. And then further down, and said board subject to the limitations of this Constitution. Mr. Chairman, this is clear. And what we've had over the years is we've had the lawyers and the judges and everybody figure out how to change the name of the land from trust land to statutory land and give it. Now, Mr. Chairman, that's not what, I mean, we can go ahead and say that our own courts and lawyers and everything have changed this around, but let's change constitutions, Mr. Chairman. Let's go to the U.S. Constitution. And this is where we ought to be paying attention under Section 8, down there about 18. It says to, and this should be on your desk, so you don't have to look it up, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may by secession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States. That's Washington, D.C. That's how they took a little piece of the states out there and pulled them together and came up with the land for Washington, D.C. But it goes on to say, Mr. Chairman, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Mr. Chairman, I would ask that you make a ruling that this is an unconstitutional bill because of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, I would like to ask the Rules Committee if they would come forward and we can meet in the, I guess, President's office and to see if you can help me out on this ruling. House Bill 156, so if the Senate will stand at ease until we get something done here, appreciate it. Committee of the Whole, please come back to order. Enough here. Just making sure we got enough. Okay, we're good. Okay, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, the Rules Committee did meet and convene to discuss the issue. If you turn your attention, if you have the Mason's legislative procedure, and I've got the 2000 version, if you look to Section 242, described as limitations on use of points of order, number one says it is not the duty of the presiding officer to rule upon any question that is not presented in the course of proceedings. It goes on to say it is not the presiding officer's right to rule upon the constitutionality or legal effect of expediency of a proposed bill, since the authority belongs to the House. So the determination of the Rules Committee is that the point of order, while proper, the presiding officer does not have the power or the capacity to rule on this constitutional matter. That lies with this body by argument.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Based upon, then, the determination of the Rules Committee, I decline to rule on the constitutionality of this, and we'll return to the discussion of the bill. Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, you guys didn't get off the easy way. So let's go back to the U.S. Constitution, and let's look about what we're talking about here. When we got the setup of Washington, D.C., they had to develop a rule or procedure on taking that land away from a state and putting it into a separate entity of that not to exceed 10 square miles out of the states, running with Virginia. But they had the wisdom back then to realize that as they went forward, this may come up again. And so let's go over the words again. And to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state, in which the same shall be for the erection of forts. We've got a few forts around here. Magazines. We got some of those. Oh, wouldn't that be cruel? We'd be storing munitions up on by Yellowstone and in Teton. I don't think we want to do that. Arsenals, same thing. Dockyards. Well, that one piece has got water on it most of the year, so I guess we could put a dock on it. And other needful buildings. Lady and gentlemen of the 61st, when we run up against things like this, I know it's difficult. And you can see what's happened with the different court cases. You go back to the Arizona case, which the Attorney General used in his argument. That was a right-of-way. They had a freeway coming in there. They wanted to go through. The commissioners there said no, and they got in a big argument. And they went all through the court system, and the United States won. Kind of reminds us of those puppies up there in Yellowstone, doesn't it? The United States won in their court. And so our Attorney General takes that and uses it as his basis, one of his bases of argument that says that we can break our Constitution now because we're going to change the name from trust land. And when you read your Constitution, it's pretty straightforward what these lands are. They're trust lands. They're not, but we figured out how to get, and we've got good lawyers around here, and they figured out how to go this way and that way and come up around here and rename them to statutory lands and say it's okay. So, and the list that that my good friend from Teton County went down, well, you've done it. You did it over here and you did it over there. I remember getting in trouble two or three times as a kid, and I'd come in and say, well, Dad, all the other kids are doing it, and it never worked. Just because everybody else did it or you've done it before doesn't make it right. So, Mr. Chairman, as much as I'd hate to, because this is probably a good deal, and it's probably the best deal, but the problem that we've had with this deal, we walked into this negotiation as a state and said, let's trade. And we've got some more case law from the judges and all the lawyers and everything to where you could trade of equal value. The federal government didn't want to trade. They said it was too much hassle to get the National Park Service and the Interior and the BLM and National Forest or anybody else. It was too hard to get those agencies to cooperate. So here, let's just do this. Let's just rewrite your Constitution and let's ignore the U.S. Constitution. We'll just buy it from you. I think it's a good deal the way they structured it. You know, they make you buy the worst piece first. But, Mr. Chairman, do you really have a worst piece of land in that area? It's all gorgeous land. It's all, I mean, it's the base of the Tetons. So the worst piece of land there is actually a pretty good chunk of land anyplace else. And that was one of their problems, Mr. Chairman, is they couldn't come up with a value for it. So they have another deal over here that they base it off of, and they finally come up with value, and it's probably not a bad deal. But, Mr. Chairman, it's not a fort, a magazine, an arsenal, a dockyard, or other needful buildings. It's dirt and trees and sagebrush that we're trying to sell the federal government. And, Mr. Chairman, it's just not right, and I'd hope you vote no on this bill.
Senator Christensen, I believe you were up first, then I'll go back to Mr. Vice President.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We had some thought-provoking ideas presented to us by the good senator. And just first one statement, I have to say that in my heart, I don't know that Wyoming has a worst piece of land. And so if I used that terminology earlier, I certainly apologize, because I think all of Wyoming is outstanding. But if I could focus our attention, let's start on the big picture and then come back down. If you'll go back to that contract, the agreement of conveyance that I was reading from earlier between the Wyoming Board of Land Commissioners and the Department of Interior on page 2. And now we'll start with the fourth, whereas on page 2 of 10 on that agreement. This is the one from the state, not the agreement for conveyance, the contract. Whereas the Secretary of Interior, now we're talking about the nation here, through the National Park Service is responsible for administration and management of the park and seeks to acquire for the department those lands and interests in lands owned by the board, referenced here on above, and which upon acquisition by the department would become and be administered as part of the park. And now we get down into, we're talking specifics from the nation here, whereas Public Law 108-32, so there's some clear authorization coming from the Secretary of State, authorizes federal acquisition of state lands by donation, purchase, or exchange of certain federal lands. It's clear that it says in here what his authority is coming from the feds and what his direction is. And so you look at that from the national perspective, based on those rules. And then if we'll take it back to earlier, I talked to you about the Wyoming legislature. And it said, the Wyoming legislature has the power to direct the transfer of state school sections. And this is pursuant to the Wyoming Supreme Court's interpretation of Article 18, Section 1 and Section 3 of the Wyoming Constitution. This is further supported. Notice it's further supported. It's not based on, but supported by the case law of Lassen versus Arizona. So our Wyoming Supreme Court made their own ruling, and they did look at Lassen, but they made their own ruling independent and then also supported it with the Lassen example. And then if I could direct your attention to the document you have from our Attorney General. And on the Attorney General's report, Office of the Attorney General in your packet, and this was from to Bruce Salzberg, the Wyoming Attorney General, from Bridget Hill. In the last page of that document, the last paragraph, it says, in summary, consistent with this office's advice on these types of transactions in the past, consistent with this office's advice on these types of transactions in the past, a legislatively directed transfer to the Department of Interior is arguably constitutional based on the reasoning of Lassen and Riedel. Indeed, this particular transaction is aided by the fact that the entity to which the transfer is will be made is the very entity that granted the state these lands and imposed a public auction requirement when doing so. The purpose of that public auction requirement is fulfilled, and the state land trust is protected because full compensation will be received. Now, I've come at this from a number of different directions, but ladies and gentlemen, the idea here is to answer those questions that are being posed with good examples, but as you can see, there's a variety of different supporting documentation, supporting opinions that I believe answers that question very clearly.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, if the Constitution were to be read as literally and without exceptions for public purposes, several hours ago this morning, we would have had a different approach with respect to whether or not certain agencies can be funded by appropriation. Because when you look at the Constitution, it looks like it's broadly stated with no exception. In many instances, you do have to rely on interpretations of the Constitution. So it seems to me that we also have a trust obligation to our schools. And part of that obligation is to maximize all property and for the benefit of the schools, because ultimately the trust is there not so much to design to protect the right of somebody to bid. We're not here trying to protect bidders that would like to put a hotel on it. Rather, we're here to protect the schools and the income for the schools. The concern I have of the bill is a little bit different. We're asked and told to believe that the property has an appraisal. We haven't seen the appraisal. Maybe it's been distributed, but I haven't seen it. We're told that there's an agreement here that has been signed, but I've not seen the signing. And so I guess one of the questions is, has anybody in the legislature seen this appraisal, the full appraisal, and at least done a read of it to make sure that, in fact, that's the appraised value and that it's not discounted or a discounted price? That's question one. Question two, has anybody seen the signed agreement? Is there a reason, and I guess part of that is a reason why we're not getting the signed agreements and the appraisal, because if the proposition is that this is an appropriate appraised price, that is a fundamental decision that the legislature makes. And while we can delegate that to the subcommittees, to our committees to make representations to us, I just like to know that people have actually seen it. With respect to the structure of the bill, I remain concerned that the bill simply authorizes sales of property for not less than the appraised value. Why doesn't the bill say we will authorize the sale of the property for an appraised value of $107 million? And furthermore, pursuant to an agreement that we've reviewed, and no other purpose. I mean, it looks to me like if we were to pass this law and the federal government backs out on this agreement, then if somebody else came and offered an appraisal of $10 million, there would still be authority to sell it for the $10 million. Now, part of the public purpose, incidentally, I think, is when you do the analysis, is that the lands will remain in public hands. And that's part of the public consideration that we're entitled to consider. And I think if we vote for this and our intention is for this to be sold to the federal government to remain as parklands, that ought to be part of the resolution. So I think as we move through this bill, we ought to think twice about explicitly what are we authorizing, what are the limitations of this authorization. I'm just kind of curious why those limitations weren't built into the resolution.
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of points of clarification on that. As I read the bill on page 1, line 13, it is explicit in the fact that the Board of Land Commissioners can sell these parcels to the United States Department of the Interior, and then it goes on to define specifically the parcels. Furthermore, in the amendment that was passed, Mr. Chairman, It again is explicit that the Board of Land Commissioners shall execute and deliver to the Department of the Interior in a form reasonably acceptable the document. So I believe that concerns related to the designated recipient of the land, while certainly appreciated, are probably taken care of by the language in this bill. And the concern with regard to the signatures, as I read the agreement, until there is legislative authority for the signatories or signatories to sign the agreement, we wouldn't have the ability to actually make that signature. I'm getting some head shakes here, so there might be some further clarification from my fellow colleagues on that. But that was the understanding I had, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate, the agreement that you have in front of you was the agreement we had to work with just during the noon hour after your packets were already made up, a copy of the agreement that is signed, if I can hold it up for you, I have a copy of it. So there is signatures, and it's signed by Governor Dave Friedenthal and by Thomas L. Strickland, Assistant Secretary of the Interior for the Fish and Wildlife and Parks. And so there is signatures on the agreement. As for the appraisal, in that agreement, if you'll go to page 5 of 10, I'm not sure if this answers all the question, but it does address this. It doesn't include all the information from the appraisal. It refers to updated values and what that appraisal means. And on paragraph 3 on page 5, updated values, in the event that the phased acquisition has not been completed within 5 years of the date of appraisal, either party may request that a new appraisal report be prepared for the remaining parcels. And so there's language in here that does refer to the validity of the appraisal. Now, earlier when I talked about that Kelly parcel and probably being the parcel with the most opportunity, I think again, and I'm sure it's by design, this paragraph really works to the state's favor. And if for some reason that this, through mutual agreement, goes forward and the acquisition's not been completed within 5 years of the date, that last parcel is the one that we could request for, or they could request, for an updated appraisal. And while those pieces that are landlocked, it becomes pretty arguable on their value and what you can use them for. The Kelly piece, the last one, is the one that I think if you were to come back in a few years and look for an updated appraisal, that's the one with the potential to weigh in even better when we talk about our obligation and responsibility for the students and for the schools.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Remind the body that in committee last night was pointed out by our former Attorney General, since 2003 in the state, the law has been that the legislature may direct the transfer of specific school trust lands as long as the state receives fair market value in exchange for those lands. Now, we have to adjust that to make sure we have that figure in there to make the body more comfortable, then so be it. They also noted there is no legal or constitutional requirement the school trust lands be sold only by public auction. And I agree with my good colleague from Natrona County. It is just dirt, trees, and sagebrush. But this dirt, trees, and sagebrush has been bringing us in $1,600 a year. And under this scenario, with 156, it could be bringing in $4.5 million per year from interest for our schools. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Jennings.
Mr. Jennings.
You're welcome, Senator Jennings. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jennings, proceed.
Don't mind, I'm just talking to me. Let's go back to the reference, Mr. Chairman, in the we're talking about this public law, 80132. All that is a piece stuck in public law that says that the Grand Teton Park can buy the land. I mean, this isn't any big deal to where we've changed the Constitution of the United States that exclude forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. But, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back on the discussion of the in the document that was signed there on the appraisal of that last piece. That works two ways. In committee, there was testimony that said that land prices in Teton County are fluctuating right now and may go down. So if that's true, and all of a sudden everybody else in the world doesn't see the beauty in those in that sagebrush dirt and trees that we see, and that prices start to fall in Teton County, then they could come back, the government could come back, and then they could ask for the appraisal, and then all of a sudden we have a lower appraisal. I'm kind of wondering, does that paragraph work both ways? The second, another thing that I'd like to ask Mr. Chairman is, look at what's going on in the United States today. We've got our congressional representatives in Washington pledging to find $100 million or $1 billion or what, $100 billion worth of cuts. And we sent them out there and told them to cut the expenditures in Washington. They were spending too much money. I watched some guy on the news this morning as getting ready to come down here, and he said, if we continue on this path of spending we have right now, even if we find that $100 billion, we're still going in a hole. And, Mr. Chairman, what we're saying here now is let's go out here and have the federal government give us $107 million for this land, and they can't balance the budget in Washington. Well, I guess they could go borrow some more money from that great big country over there with the red flag.
Is there any further discussion on this? Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, we've got two different constitutions that we're trying to look at from a constitutional standpoint. My good colleague from Natrona County is discussing effectively two vantage points. I would say that from our perspective as the Wyoming State Legislature, we should be worrying about the constitutionality with regard to the Wyoming State Constitution. We have an Attorney General decision that's telling us that we have standing to do this, that we're allowed to make this transaction. And while we probably should be concerned in a lot of cases about the constitutionality of various issues with regard to the U.S. Constitution, I would think that in this particular transaction, we should leave it up to the U.S. Department of the Interior. If they feel like they're allowed to enter into this transaction as the federal government, we should probably let them. I don't think it's up to us to second guess whether or not the executive branch has the authority. That's one of the things that they do, and I think that for us to be judging the constitutionality of their decisions with regard to the U.S. Constitution seems like it's more up to them, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Senator Jennings, go ahead, and I'll get to you.
Sure. All right. Then my good friend from the, I won't say Ivory Tower, from Laramie, then we should come back next year with a resolution to change the Constitution on our oath, and we will defend, obey, or let's see, we'll support, obey, and defend the Wyoming Constitution, and we'll just kind of pay attention to the U.S. Constitution a little bit. We took an oath. It was for both constitutions. It's our job to take a look at both of them and not put one of them aside for the benefit of the other. It's two constitutions. We all took that oath. We all need to be concerned about both constitutions.
Senator Barnard.
I hesitate to talk here, but I think, and I don't want to talk about the two constitutions and the constitutionality. The thing that I think we need to realize here is that if we sell this land, as the good senator from Teton County said, most of the land can't be used commercially. But the one last piece of land, which is Antelope Flat, already has an access to it, and we would buy that land for $45 million. I would submit that 5 years from now, and I don't care what happens to the federal government, that land is the most beautiful land. It's the most desirable land in, I think, the entire United States. And I would bet my whatever I've got on this that 5 years from now that land would be worth more than $46 million. So if I was going to develop a plan here, I would say to sell these off one by one for the price that they've got. take the valuation, and then on that last piece of land, try to make more money off of that 5 years from now. But that's not the real question. The question is, do we sell this land for $1 billion or whatever we can get out of it? It's 45, how many acres is it? Anyway, if we sell that land for $1 billion, or just to $46 million, do we, if we can sell it to a private person, that person can go in and develop it, and we can make a lot more money off of that land. And then instead of having $45 million, we could maybe have $150 million that we could use for interest. And the other question is, do we sell this to a private person later on who will commercialize it, or do we look to the greater good and sell it back to the government, and they keep it as a park and keep it beautiful? That I think is the other really big question. Do we have it privatized, or do we sell it to the national government and let them keep it as a park?
Senator Christensen? And I'll go to Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Christensen.
It'll be my
turn. Oh, okay. Senator Case, you go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Senator Christensen, you have to wait for a minute here.
Not if he doesn't want to, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a difficult tussle here, I suppose, but, you know, we kind of have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And if you can find it in your hearts that it is constitutional, you know, it's one of those things you probably should take. Truly, the good senator's right. You know, I have preached Constitution on this floor more than probably anyone, except for maybe the tall senator from Natrona County. And it does strike me, you know, that issue about the federal government has the power to just have these certain small places, relatively limited holdings of land. You know, we've been a country now for well over 200 years, and they certainly have accumulated more than dockyards, arsenals, and I'm not a total scholar on how that's been done, but it's been done, and it is legal. I don't like it, and I'd like them to probably follow the original intent of the Constitution. But I'm not the one that gets to interpret the Constitution. I get to tell you what I think on this floor. It's the courts that interpret the Constitution. So we're down to the fact that we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It is very, very difficult to consummate this sale. I mean, it's very difficult to realize that value from that land. We had the opportunity a few years ago where we were working on a similar school section near the town of Jackson Hole on the way to Teton Village. And that is similar situated. We are getting a grazing lease out of that. I think there actually is a little bit of other operation on that, but nowhere near the value of that land. And I believe I was in the House at that time, and the state land board appointed me to be on a commission to try to develop a way to realize value out of that piece of school ground. And it just became enormously difficult to actually effectuate that, to put it to auction, to put it to other uses. You couldn't get it done. The political uproar in Teton County was huge. And as a result, that land is still used for minimal uses today. You know, it's worth millions of dollars. At that time, we had $40 million potential realization for the school trust on that one section. And all these years since, we've never realized a dime for the children of Wyoming. And the argument was about open space and protecting the rural character and visual landscape in Teton County. And I'm all for that. But I don't want the school children of Wyoming to pay for that. I want the people in Teton County and the visitors to Teton County to pay that. Well, I lost. And we'll never, ever be able to do anything with that land. And that's a different school section, but the lesson is perfectly applicable here. Because we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to realize some value, and the land's use won't change at all. And I shouldn't be quite so careful, because the lease factors that the state has may not be continued by the federal government. But the basic open character of the land, the fact that it is available for enjoyment of the people of Wyoming and the people of the United States, will not change. At the same time, we get an enormous amount of money that we can invest for the benefit of the school children, which is what the land was originally set aside for. So we actually realize, in the end, what our founders envisioned and what the grantees from the federal government envisioned when they established those school sections. We actually realize the value for the children of Wyoming and their future. And this is the only way to do it. And we're never going to get another chance. And we got to do this.
Senator Christensen. Oh, okay. Back to Senator Jennings then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you really want to keep that land the way it is, and you want to guarantee that it will never change, then keep the land. The only way that we can guarantee that that will stay in the state it is for us to retain the ownership of it. There's other ways that we can get the money. Where was the lease option? Why couldn't, you know, we're supposed to trade it. That was fair enough. The feds didn't want to trade it. But we go in there and we've got to yammer about all this Constitution stuff. Can they really do it? Well, lawyers and courts will figure out a way to do whatever they want to do. But if you really want to keep that land pristine and you want to keep it the way it is, then have the federal government lease it from us for the same amount of money, but they will keep those boundaries around them, and they can't do anything else with it but keep it pure and keep it like it is. There's a lot of other possibilities that should have been explored that weren't explored because the federal government wouldn't trade us, and I feel, and I, my heart goes out to the guys that were doing the negotiating, but I think they stopped too soon. There's other avenues on it. Let's protect the land. The school foundation, we're hanging in there. We're paying the bills. And every time, there's been several other times that people have looked at selling or buying that land. Every time in the past, it was worth less money. It's appreciated every time. Let's appreciate appreciation. Keep it under our own control. Lease it to Teton Park if they really want it. And then we can guarantee that it will stay like it is.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to stay out of this, but, you know, I think this is a wonderful deal. I really do. I thought about this. You know, I've been here through boom and bust, and I know there's another senator right up front here that has, and we struggled with funding schools. We struggled with funding anything. But when you think about this, you think about putting $107 million to work for you, and you think about the $4.5 million a year, and then you think about the compounding effect of it. Think about the compounding effect out there 15, 20 years from today. Or think about the compounding effect of $2,000 a year. This is serious stuff because in the future, we don't know where we're going to be in the future with minerals. And they're funding 65% of everything we do. That's going to change. Think about the future of the schools. Try to have enough foresight to take this money and compound the income off of it. I'd prefer to rather call it the Common School Land Income Fund, call it the Common School Land Endowment Fund for the future. We might need that someday. And I think with this amount of money to put it to work for us right now makes good common sense for the future of schools in the state of Wyoming. I ask that you support the bill.
Senator, okay, question being called. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 156, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Okay. House Bill 156 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 177.
House Bill 177, Vietnam and Veterans Welcome Home and Thank You Day, an act relating to state holidays and observances, sponsored by Representative Yagi. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Landon, and Nutting. No, Senator Johnson and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 177, and to present this bill, I yield to Senator Nutting.
Senator Nutting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 177, Vietnam and Other Veterans Welcome Home Day, is a bill that was originally presented in the U.S. Senate by U.S. Senator Richard Burr. He encouraged all states in the Union to establish a Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day, and that has been done in many of the states. So in doing this, Wyoming will be joining other states in the Union. A date was set aside to welcome home these veterans, March 30th. That date was selected because on March 29th, 1973, the remaining combat veterans left Vietnam and got back to America on March 30th. Other returning veterans prior to this had usually received parades and celebrations welcoming them back. Many of the Vietnam veterans kind of snuck back into the country. They were told to not even wear their uniforms when they returned back. So that this day is not honoring or not specifically honoring veterans from previous wars who have had that honor of being welcomed home. This day is to make up something that our country should have done in 1973, and we didn't do it, and many veterans are still suffering because of that neglect. The bill itself contains some historical references so that you can look back and see some dates that happened in the Vietnam War. We learned a lot of lessons from that, and veterans since then have been welcomed back better. But we want this date to also be a reminder to us as a nation that we're proud of our veterans and that we always want to welcome them back. And by designating March 30th of every year, it gives us another opportunity to say thank you to those veterans, to give them that thank you that they should have had years ago. It is a way of saying that to them that we wish we had welcomed them back then, and that we do welcome them back today. It follows a custom of Vietnam veterans who sometimes will say to each other, welcome back, because they were deprived of that, and they give that welcome back to each other now, and we want to participate in that also. This is at no cost. It does not call for any closure of public schools or public buildings. In fact, the idea of the celebrations is for those institutions to be open so that they will, in the process of the day, remember the Vietnam and later veterans. The Korean War veterans are also included in this. The Korean War veterans often consider themselves the forgotten veterans because when they returned home, people had forgotten that they were even in a war. And so it's remembering those Korean veterans, Vietnam veterans who were not welcomed home as they should have been. And it's a reminder that we do welcome back our Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans. So I ask for a favorable passage of this bill.
Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the sponsor. On the last page, it says the governor not later than March 20th of each year, and then the effective date's immediately. So if this was to be signed by him towards the end of this session, it would be like March 3rd or something. And then did anybody discuss that, you know, he has a week or 10 days or so to get something together Was there a reason that it has to be effective immediately or given time, or is he all set to write it? I don't know. I'm just looking at two dates.
Senator Nutting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The March 20th was selected so that other organizations would have 10 days to prepare their celebration. It's effective immediately, so it gives the governor time to prepare for March 20th.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 177, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
Okay. House Bill 170. Oh, excuse me. Senator Schiffer.
I'd like to exercise my rights under Senate Rule 16-5.
Okay, Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I was a no vote on this bill. And those of you who know me know that in the course of my career here, I have consistently supported and worked to take care of active duty personnel, National Guard men and women. I've tried to improve both the conditions under which they operate, under which they train. I've tried my best to take care of their families. We've been sort of successful at that. I believe we've enhanced the facilities. When they have to go into harm's way, they are better prepared. But I will suggest to you, and by way of provenance, Mr. Chairman, I am a Vietnam veteran. I spent 14 months at a river detachment at a town nobody's ever heard of, and I hope I never hear of again. But I will tell you this. You do not go fight for thank yous, or for God, or for country, or any of that other stuff. You go fight for your shipmates. You go fight for your comrades. That's why you fight. When it comes down to the nitty-gritty, all the rest of that stuff doesn't mean diddle squat. You fight for the people you serve with. And thank yous are good, but they're just words. They're nothing more than that. And they're words that come much too late. And they probably don't mean anything. I would suggest, while this is a well-intentioned bill, as a matter of fact, it's the best of intentions. It's a feel-good bill. I would suggest that this Senate devote its efforts to taking care, going forward, of our military, of their families, make sure they're trained correctly, make sure they're taken care of when they're overseas, and their families are taken care of when they're here. And to pass this and say, now we feel good because somebody in West Virginia did it, I will suggest to you, the reason you fight is to take care of your own, and it behooves this Senate to take care of our own and do it in a meaningful way. And that will accomplish a million times more than what this bill will do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schiffer, this may not ever be enough, but we are grateful for your service, and we would like to tell you that. So thank you. House Bill 177 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 2.
House Joint Resolution 2, Resolution U.S. Constitution requiring a balanced budget, a joint resolution requesting Congress submit to the states a proposed amendment to the United States Constitution requiring a balanced budget except in times of war or declared national emergency, sponsored by Representative Croker. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerichson, Hines. No, Senator Perkins, Senator Hines, Chairman.
You heard the reading of the bill. What What is your pleasure, Senator Hines?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on House Joint Resolution 4. I will yield to one of the sponsor. I don't know whether prepared or not.
This is House Joint Resolution 2. Is that what you said? Joint Resolution 2?
2.
Yes, okay. Just clarifying. Thank you. Senator Nutting.
Mr. Chairman, this is a resolution. It is recognizing that we as a state stay within our budget. We expect our citizens to stay within their budgets. And we're passing this resolution asking that our representatives to the United States Congress carry our message there that we're asking that the United States government stay within its budget also. So this is a resolution asking for a balanced federal budget.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, in the U.S. Constitution, there are two ways, theoretically, that the Constitution can be amended. One is through the Congress passing with two-thirds in each House a constitutional amendment, submitting it to the several states for ratification. The other is with the Congress calling a constitutional convention on application of two-thirds of the several states, a constitutional convention for proposing amendments. Mr. Chairman, I note in this bill, as far as I can tell, the total absence of the words calling for a constitutional convention. So it is my understanding of this, and I hope everybody will take a careful look, and if I'm wrong, somebody will correct me, because a call for a constitutional convention is a very serious matter. I notice the absence of those words in this resolution. So it's my interpretation that this is just an ordinary run-of-the-mill memorial to Congress saying, gee, we wish you would do this sort of thing, and not a call for a constitutional convention as provided in Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, where they have to act if they get enough states calling. Mr. Chairman, I hope if I'm wrong that somebody will clarify me, because it changes by many orders of magnitude the seriousness of this particular joint resolution.
Senator Landon. As I find you here, there you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate those words from my Natrona County colleague. And I just wanted to share a couple thoughts when I read this last night, a couple of quick thoughts. One is, the first thought was about the former senator from Teton County, and wish he was here today to see what he would say at the back of the room. We know what rule that is. It starts with an L, and his last name, and that was the rule that we don't vote for resolutions. But so I thought of him. But then I also thought of a graduate course that I took, and it was in political economy. And greatly enjoyed that course, and we studied Friedman and others. And at that time I came to learn that most of the debt that the federal government has, we owe to ourselves. That's a tiny slice, and that's as far as I'll go today, because the good senator back in the back corner of the room can take you a lot further than that, and I know there's others in here who can talk a lot more about political economy and how complicated and difficult a topic that is. But the point I'm making is, I'm not even sure this is a good idea, you know, for the federal government to necessarily balance its budget like we balance this one, simply because, as I said, oftentimes we owe the money to ourselves.
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. When I first read this, I thought, this is a pretty cool idea. Let's have them do this, balance their budget, kind of like what we do. And then there's this guy here in the chamber that I said that to, and he goes, yeah, it's just what they want. Mandatory balance to the budget, and we'll hook it onto the tax increases, and they come up with a budget, and the taxes automatically go up. And ever since he said that a few minutes ago, I've been thinking about it, and maybe this isn't such a good idea. It sounds like it, but maybe it's not.
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, this will be quick. I would like, I'm new on these resolutions. This is about the seventh we've seen. I would like one of the more senior senators who's been around for a while, perhaps the one from Natrona County, Mr. Chairman, to suggest a time when this has worked, when we've requested something from U.S. Congress and they've said, State of Wyoming, we're here to help. I just want to know, because I'm sort of leaning towards the Larson rule, not to use his name on the floor, but I think if we start calling it that and it just becomes indoctrinated, we'll be okay with it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senior Senator Geis. Whoops.
Time with these. We passed around, we signed them, and sent them back there. That's how much we thought they were worth.
Thank you, Senior Senator Geis. Is there any more senior senators? Question being called. Okay. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Joint Resolution Number 2, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Oh, well, okay. All right. So this calls for a standing division. So all those in favor, please stand. Okay, all those opposed, please stand. Oh. Okay. Pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, having failed the standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout excused. Burns?
No.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
Dockstader? Driscoll?
No.
Emmerich?
No.
Esquibel?
No.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
No.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
No.
Martin?
No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins excused. Peterson?
No.
Ross? Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
No.
Bonflatern?
No.
President Anderson excused. Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 5 ayes, 22 noes, and 3 excused.
Okay. House Joint Resolution Number 2, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 6. Will the reading clerk please read the joint resolution?
House Joint Resolution 6, Private Property Protection, a joint resolution requesting Congress to refrain from enacting any law which restricts private property rights in violation of the United States Constitution. Sponsored by Representative Hunt. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll. No, Senators Burns and Esquibel. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the House Joint Resolution. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Joint Resolution 6, Private Property Protection. There are no standing committee amendments, and if you like the last one, you're going to love this one.
Okay.
And to further explain this resolution, I ask you to call on the good senator right in front of me.
Senator Driscoll.
I got your back there.
Okay.
Wow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know about L rules, and I came down
the
L
rule.
I'd like to talk to you about House Joint Resolution Number 6. This is a great resolution, and this actually is somewhat different. I'm used to the resolutions that go to the federal government, and this one is in regards to private property rights. And as we all know, federal government has been a huge problem with private property rights in Wyoming. So has the state government, so have our locals. And, you know, we've kind of, as we've gone through the years, as it's gone on, if you're a private property rights owner, that bundle of sticks has got picked away just a little bit. If you look at these constitutional deals that we're talk about, we could have a couple guys stand up. We don't tend to follow the Constitution all the time. You know, it's, well, it's just a little pick off the edge on the guy. And we've done that through the years really steady. And, you know, if you own a piece of ground, you found out that there's been a pretty constant slide of where you're at. Part of it's because the officials have forgot what private property rights are. And this goes section at a time, asks them, doesn't force them to do anything. It asks them to look at private property rights, understand what they are, and put some thought into their decisions of what it does to someone who owns private property rights. When you're condemning that line across it for the power line, you're doing your local planning. If you look at the last page of this, this isn't just for the federal round basket. This is to be spent to the local officials, to the state officials. And I can tell you that's part of why I came down here, is private property rights are, we have heck with them every day around here. And we pass bills, we take them away piece at a time, and you can sure feel it. If you own ground or you run a business, you feel it every day. This resolution actually does something that can have a positive effect. When a county commissioner that comes in that's never owned a piece of ground comes in, a city official, when they see this, you may get one person that thinks twice about what they do. If we do that, it's worth it to send a piece of paper, guys. That's all it takes is one person. We're asking for people to think about what they do. We're asking for something else. We ask ourselves to pick up the Constitution, read it every day. This has got sections of it in it. It says, please read it. Take a look at it, read it, and think about what you're doing to guys that own property. I encourage you to move ahead with this. I move to do it, and I'll stand for questions.
Any discussion on the bill? No. Okay. No further discussion. All right. Okay, all those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Joint Resolution 6, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
Oh, okay, it doesn't sound like to me it's made it. So we'll have a standing division. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Okay. Pursuant to set resolution 11-5, having failed the standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. Will the chief clerk please call the roll?
Barnard. Bebout excused. Burns. Case. Christensen. Coe. Cooper.
No.
Dockstader. Driscoll. Emmerich. Esquibel. Geis.
No.
Hastert.
No.
Hicks. Hines. Jennings. Johnson. Landon. Martin.
No.
Meyer.
No.
Nicholas.
No.
Nutting.
No.
Perkins excused. Peterson.
No.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
No.
Von Flatern?
No.
President Anderson excused. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 9 ayes, 18 noes, 3 excused.
House Joint Resolution Number 6, having failed the roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, is deemed indefinitely postponed. And Mr. Majority Leader, Floor Leader, yes, too. That clears the desk. Oh, sorry. Get you here just a second. Okay, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, it's yours.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You heard the motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Oh, motion adopted. Motion passed, too. Whatever. Sorry.
Okay. We have reports of static news. Okay, good. The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Vice President, Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 2, do pass. House Bill 4, do pass. House Bill 76, do pass. House Bill 101, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Bill 105, do pass. House Bill 133, do pass. House Bill 156, do pass amended. House Bill 177, do pass. House Joint Resolution 2, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Joint Resolution 6, failed to pass a Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senator Cooper, Chairman.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion is carried. And the report has been adopted. Reports from standing committees.
February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 255, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins, Senator Hines, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 153, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins, Senator Hines, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 254, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins, Senator Hines, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 81, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 10th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 7, Corporation Election and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 5, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. No, Senator Hines, Senator Case, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. Vice President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, February 11th.
Announcement, Senator Scott.
Mr. Vice President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the usual committee room. House Bill 39, Health Litigation Fund. House Bill 184, Minimum Wage Statutes Repeal. House Bill 193, Nursing Care Facility Assessment.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Vice President, your committee number 5, Resources, will meet in about 10 minutes to take up House Bill 151, Engrossed, Hydropower Development, House Bill 230, Engrossed, Eminent Domain Wind Energy Collector System 2, House Bill 135, Engrossed, State Lands Improvements 2, House Bill 7, Wyoming Veterinary Medicine Practice Act 2, House Bill 174, Designated Transfer of State Lands, House Bill 202, Railroad Fence Repairs, and House Bill 223, Property Disclosure State Wind Estates.
Senator Cole.
And then for breakfast they're having. Okay. Yeah, Mr. Vice President, your committee number 4, Education, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock over in S11 to hear House Bill 264, Hathaway Scholarships, School Notifications. House Bill 214, Engrossed, Hathaway Scholarship College Attendance. House Bill 241, Engrossed School Districts Assessments. And House Bill 85, Engrossed Teacher Suspensions.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Vice President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet in about 10 minutes in S13 to hear House Bill 40, Engrossed Compensation for Persons Exonerated Based on DNA. House Bill 129, Engrossed Nuclear Energy Production Study. House Bill 139, Wyoming Veterans Memorial Highway. We also will continue work on House Bill 5, University Revenue Bond Supplemental Coverage, and House Bill 37, State Archive Storage Study. We also meet upon adjournment tomorrow in S13 to consider House Bill 127, Engrossed, School Finance Recalibration, Bill 72, Engrossed, Teacher Merit Pay, and House Bill 217, Engrossed, Production States Agreement.
Senator Cooper.
Education Committee number 9 will meet in 15 minutes after noon hour tomorrow up in S18 here in the north area. And we will be considering House Bill 260, Industrial Siting Financial Resources, House Bill 93, School Unification Student Count Deletion, and House Bill 204, Engrossed Patriotism in the Classroom, and House Bill 227, Education, Constitution, Instruction, and House Bill 144, Engrossed School District Bonds.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Vice President, Judiciary Committee number 1 will meet in room S1 tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock to consider House Bill 159, Engrossed Uniform Trust Code Amendments, House Bill 157, Abolition of Worthier Title Doctrine, House Bill 158, Rule Against Perpetuities.
Are there any additional motions or announcements? If not, all those in favor of the majority floor leader's motion to adjourn, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, February 11th. Oh, 10 a.m. Thank you. 10 a.m.